Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on learning from our mistakes when we come back. You know, during World War II, our parents and grandparents planted victory gardens, and that helped to provide their own food and fiber for themselves and their country. Now today, more than half of the food that we eat is imported from outside of our borders. Our food is produced from hybrid seed that will not reproduce, and it is nutritionally deficient. Now, Adolf Steinbrunn of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter into perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients that are usually added to commercial feeds. When compared to more than 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year, Steinbrunn's open-pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, and 205% more manganese, and the same result has been also seen in the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. Now, in the opinion of many ecologic farmers, hybrid seed merely masks poor farming practices by producing bins and bushels of foodless food without the nutrients that are really food's reason for being in the first place. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies and how you can become independent from them, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and it's free of charge. You can call right now and order one. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? Learning from our mistakes. I worked for a guy one time, a short period of time, I think it was 3 weeks. His name was John Newhart. He was an old man when I was a young kid. And one night we came in to eat, and we sat down. In fact, I think it was the first night I was there on the job. Came in to sit down and eat. And we had strawberry shortcake for dinner. I mean, it was dessert, but, you know, after dinner we had the strawberry shortcake. God, it was good. Mrs. Newhart was a great cook, and she always had neat desserts, and she just had a wonderful dinner table. I always liked eating there. Well, anyway, what I noticed about the old man was, old John Newhart was, is that he ate his dessert first. So when we sat down to eat, and the rest of us are eating meat and potatoes, and old man Newhart sitting over there at the head of the table eating his strawberry shortcake. So we all knew what was for dessert. When he got through with his strawberry shortcake, we were having second helpings, and then he takes a piece of meat. So I had just meat. He's just eating meat now. Strawberry shortcake is the first course, meat's the second course. He gets through eating the meat, and then he reaches over, he takes the vegetables. Now, about this time, it's time for us to have our strawberry shortcake. So while we're eating strawberry shortcake, he's sitting over there eating Brussels sprouts. Well, needless to say, I thought to myself, this guy's backwards. Well, I don't know. Neither he's backwards or we are. Maybe we should start with strawberry shortcake. You ever stop and think about that? Was it a mistake to eat meat and potatoes first and then eat the strawberry shortcake last? Or would it be better to eat the strawberry shortcake first and then eat the meat and potatoes and then eat the Brussels sprouts last? Unable to contain myself when dinner was over, I said, Mr. Newhart, I noticed that when we sat down to eat tonight that you ate your dessert first. And when the rest of us were eating dessert, you were eating your vegetable. Now, I wouldn't say that that's necessarily backwards, but I got to tell you that I'm really curious as to why you eat that way. And he said, very simple, son. If you always eat the best first, you will always have the best. And he said, I esteem strawberry shortcake much higher than I do Brussels sprouts. And so, if I eat the Brussels sprouts, meat and potatoes, I might be so full that I would miss my dessert. He said, have you ever noticed when people get through eating and when dessert is offered, you know, which is really the best part of dinner is dessert, they have to pass on dessert, and they always say, oh, my God, I couldn't eat another bite. I'm too full. So he said, I took a look at that, and I said, you know, since I like dessert more than anything else at dinner, I think I'll eat dessert first, and then I'll go ahead and eat, and then when I get full, I'll be full of Brussels sprouts, and then when somebody says, would you like to have some more Brussels sprouts, I can tell them, no, no, I'm so full I couldn't eat another bite. But I'm not missing my strawberry shortcake, I'm missing Brussels sprouts. And he said, I hate them anyway. Now, you know, that might sound like a humorous story, but you know, there's a lot to be learned from that. In business, we call that cherry picking. Cherry picking. I can remember as a young man, I used to go out and bid jobs in, oftentimes just to keep my crew busy. I do it to keep my men together, keep them working. Today, I don't do that. I don't have any crew to keep working. I don't have any men out there I'm concerned about. And so now when somebody pitches me a deal, they want to make some kind of an offer to me, you know, I look and I listen, I mull it over, and then most of the time I pass. I pass on all of the mediocre jobs. I pass on all of the frivolous jobs. And I'm only interested in those jobs that pay the most, have the greatest profit, and are the easiest to perform. In other words, I don't want to work, and I want to make a lot of money at the same time. So I want to cherry pick and just take the best jobs. I want to eat the best first, and then I will always have the best. Now, tuck that one away in your heart, because we're going to talk about learning from our mistakes. And I think it was Henry Ford. Sometimes I get mixed up, maybe it was Thomas Edison or somebody else, but I'm pretty sure it was all Henry Ford. I made an observation one time. And he said, you'll learn more from your mistakes than you will from your successes. Mull that one over for a minute. You're going to learn more from your mistakes than you do your successes. Well, my old dad told me the same thing in different words. He said, experience is the best teacher, but it's a god-awful hard way to learn. I've mentioned that to you a few times. For you young people out there, you know, life is just beginning, and you're just full of it, and you're just ready to get out there and cut a fat hog in the back. As you get a little bit older, there's an old adage that goes like this. Two bulls, an old bull and a young bull, are standing on top of a grassy knoll, looking down the pasture. And the young bull, looking down the pasture, spies a bunch of heifers down at the bottom of the hill. And he says to the old bull, let's run down there and breed one of them. And the old bull looks at the young bull and he says, son, let's walk down there and breed them all. Now, you know, there's a little bit of wisdom that comes from old age. And you take a look at the youth and you say, boy, they waste a lot of energy over here and then accomplish very little. Whereas the old-timer, he doesn't waste near as much energy, and he accomplishes a whole lot more. So let's see if we can learn from our mistakes and if we can't make something better out of it. Now, typically when we're trying to measure, we like to measure in money. We measure in money. Money is the methodology that we use here in the United States for keeping track of our successes. When a guy's got $100,000 in the bank, we all gasp and go, wow, that's really great. He's got $1 million in the bank, woo, that's even 10 times better. But when a guy's got $100,000 or $200,000 in gold buried in a hole in the ground, we gasp and say, why are you doing that? Well, the guy that has his gold buried in a hole in the ground has already experienced bank failure. And because of that bank failure, he says to himself, well, I don't want to suffer the losses that I did the last time around. Now, the banks aren't done either, see, so they came up with a plan back in the last depression. They said, well, we'll give these guys federal deposit insurance. So today, people put their money in the bank with great confidence, having never learned the lesson of the last Great Depression when the banks failed. And that's because time goes on, and like the old story of the camel sticking his nose in the tent, pretty soon he sticks his head in, pretty soon his neck, pretty soon his shoulders, and then a little later on, you're out in the sandstorm and the camel's in your tent, and you wonder, well, what happened here? How'd that camel get into my tent, and how come I'm out here in the sandstorm? And that's because you didn't learn. You didn't learn from your mistakes. This has been going on for thousands of years. The bank failures that are going on today, like Lehman Brothers, that's been going on for thousands and thousands of years. Nothing new there. The losses that people took at Enron, the losses that people are taking today in their real estate and their houses and their 401ks and their stock portfolios, been going on for thousands of years. There's nothing new here. Well, then how come these people are taking these losses? They didn't learn from their mistakes. Or worse, they didn't learn from the mistakes of others. They didn't learn from the mistakes of the generations that have gone before us. Now, here's another old adage. It says, he who fails to learn from history is doomed to learn from it, or is doomed to make the same mistakes again. Well, we didn't learn anything from World War I because it led us to World War II. And we didn't learn anything from World War II because now we're headed toward World War III. In the last Great Depression, we didn't learn anything from it because now we're embroiled in another Great Depression. And what's worse is that we had a depression in 1783 through 1787. And in 1787, our founding fathers, when they created our Constitution, they solved the Great Depression of the 1780s. They solved it. And it took them about 36 months to do it. 36 months. And they did it with gold and silver coin, and they did it with Article 1, Section 10 in our Constitution, and then with a statutory provision called the Coinage Act of 1792. They actually took action. They took action based upon the mistakes that they'd made in the past. Let me tell you a little story about the mistakes. It's called the monetary system, called paper currency. Well, back about 1690 in Massachusetts, December of 1690, to be a little more precise, Massachusetts issued 7,000 pounds of printed bills of equal value with money. In May of 1691, they issued 30,000 pounds of printed bills, and in July of 1692, they made all of these bills of public credit current within this province and all payments equivalent to money, accepting specialties and contracts made before the publication of this new law. Now, as a result of that, almost immediately all of the coin then in Massachusetts was exported to England, and new stock followed as fast as it came in from abroad. Trade and commerce declined, and hard times came upon the people. In 1964, President Johnson did the same thing. Same thing. He took silver coin out of circulation by minting these clad coins. And within 36 months, all of the silver coin disappeared from our circulation, money circulation. And then hard times came upon the people in the 1970s. We had a long, drawn-out recession. It lasted for about 10 years, maybe longer. All was up and down. I don't deny that, but the 1970s were really kind of a bad economic time. We didn't learn from the Great Depression. We didn't learn from the experience that we got in the 1780s. So in the 1970s, we did essentially the same thing without as bad a result. And then we didn't learn anything from the paper money issue. All of the colonies, South Carolina in May of 1703, New Hampshire in 1709, Connecticut in 1709, New York 1709, Rhode Island 1710, South Carolina 1712, all of those colonies issued paper money, and all of them came up with the same result. Over a period of time, by 1754, they had all gone broke. They all had an average loss of 90%, and Adam Smith wrote his caveat on the injustice of paper money. So Adam Smith wrote that caveat on the foibles of paper money. So as time goes on, boys and girls, and history marches on, we don't learn very much. I reported to you not too long ago that Henry Morgenthau, who was the Secretary of the Treasury in the Roosevelt years, in 1939, he was testifying before Congress. And he said in the preceding 6 years, referring back to 1933 and add six to 1939, he said, we've just done everything we could think of to stimulate the economy, to get the country back on track. And he said at the end of 6 years, every single thing they tried failed. Hell, this wasn't a Republican on the outside saying, hey, you Democrats are all failures. This was the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau. He was the Democrat. He was the insider. He was in the administration. He said, everything we've tried has failed. Nothing's worked. Unemployment today is as bad or worse than it was in 1933 or 35. So based upon that statement, have we learned anything here in the current depression coming down our track? We are doing exactly the same things today that we did back in the 1930s, and we can just about expect the same results that they got. Now, what they did in the 1780s, they got off of paper money and went to gold and silver coin. Nobody is talking about getting off of paper money and going back to gold and silver coin. They're all talking about how we can stimulate the economy and prevent depression, deflation. Well, listen, deflation is good for the little guy. Deflation's bad for the banks, the politicians, and big business, but it's not bad for us. Hey, listen, when gasoline went from $2 to $4, that was inflation, that was bad, and we all complained. When gasoline went from $4 to $2, that's deflation. We all benefited. Who's complaining? Well, the Arab sheiks and the big oil companies and government. It costs government tax revenue. The government makes more money off of $4 gas than they do $2 gas. And the corporations, they make more money off of $4 gas than $2 gas. So, listen, the bankers make more money off of $4 gas than $2 gas. The guys that want inflation and are terrified of deflation are the banks, the politicians, and the big businesses. They're the ones that are concerned about deflation. Hell, for all the rest of us, it's the best thing since sliced white bread. But we can't learn from our mistakes in the past, so we've got to do the same thing over again. Well, now, I'm not going to change the current administration. I'm not going to change the course of events to prevent World War II or World War III. That's beyond me. I'm just Joe Sixpack. But you know, World War II affected a lot of people. And World War III is going to affect a lot of people. And I want to be one of the people that is least affected by World War III. And looking back on it, I can see how I could have been even less affected by World War II. And that comes from learning from our mistakes. Now, more importantly, can we learn from other people's mistakes? That's where the real key to success lies. And that That's called revelation. Revelation. Now, revelations don't just come from God. Revelations come from history. You know, by looking at Smith's treatise on the injustice of a fluctuating currency back in the 1750s, if we could learn from that, it would put money in our pockets today in 2009. And that's the genius of learning from other people's mistakes. So let's take a look at some mistakes. I'm going to share some experiences with you. Let's see if we can't help you score more dollars, not in the bank, more dollars in your hole in the ground. Let's see if we can put more ounces of gold and fewer dollars into that hole in the ground. I mean, if that's the way you count and that's the way you keep track of success. So World War I, II, and III, that's been a total failure, and we're doomed to repeat our mistakes. Depressions number one and two, we didn't learn from the depression in the 1780s, and so that one is a given. We're going to go through that one again. Now, mistakes are better than our successes, because we had a success from 1783 till about 1933. In 1783, the continental currency collapsed. In 1933, Roosevelt closed all the banks. So in that period of time, we had some experience and we had some success. And then we had an ultimate failure here in the depression of the 1930s. We got out of that with World War II. After World War II, we've had a few recessions, no big bad ones. Final verdict is coming in now in the year 2009. Now, this depression here started in August of 2007. So if you want to put a date on it like we did with the depression of the 1930s, October of 1929 is when it started. Well, August of 2007 is when this one started. So in August of 2008 and in August of 2009 and August of 2010, we're going to be in this thing. You know, all the experts tell us and our experience in history tells us it's going to be years in its duration. But the depression of the 1780s ended in 36 months. It ended because they went back to gold and silver coin. Once they introduced just weights and balances, boy, it didn't take long to reach the bottom and then go up from there. So by looking back at the 1780s, our mistakes can be better than our successes. Now let me start off here and I'll tell you a little story. Most people see government as their friend. I mean, if you go out here and ask the average Joe Sixpack about his views concerning government and government agencies, it's going to be pretty favorable. He might complain because there's a Democrat in office as opposed to a Republican, and he might complain about some specifics. But as a general thought, everybody believes that government is their friend. But our experience tells us exactly the opposite to that. Exactly. So one day I had this spray booth down here in my factory, and I had a painter down there working in the spray booth. And I asked my painter, I said, "Now, Mr. Painter, what is it that you need in the spray booth?" And he would tell me, he says, "I need this, that, and another thing," and I got it for him. And I said, "Now, Mr. Painter, what do you need in the spray booth?" He says, "Well, I need this, that, and another thing," and I got it for him. And I said, "Now, Mr. Painter, what do you need in the spray booth?" And he said, "Well, I've got just about everything I need, but there's a few things I would like to have." I said, "What is it?" He told me, and I got him for him. So my painter, he's just happy as a clam at high tide. And he's working for a boss that's concerned about him, concerned about his production, concerned about what his needs are, and I got him for him. I can't think of anything that I didn't get Rick. When he wanted it, I got it for him. All right. So Rick is happy, and everything's going along fine. One day, an OSHA inspector comes in. See, this is the Occupational Safety Outfit. It's a bureaucracy here in the United States. Occupational Self and Health. OSHA, Safety and Health Administration, I think it is, OSHA. And he came in and he did an inspection there in our plant, and he wrote up a pretty long blistering criticism of concerning the spray booth. And I pointed out to the man, I said, "Now the painter that works down there, he's pretty happy with it." And the bureaucrat said, "Oh my God, it's a health hazard, it's unsafe, and it's unsafe at any speed, and that painter is going to get killed down there. He's going to die a long, painful death from emphysema," something. You know? I said, "Okay." So the OSHA man came up with his OSHA standards, and he said, "Here's the way we want this spray booth built. We want you to tear out what you got here, and we want you to rebuild it." Now, as I recall, the cost at that time, I think it was $8,000. As I recall, $8,000 is what I had to spend back in the 70s. Now, $8,000 is quite a bit of money. At least for us, in our little struggling company, it was. So I told him, "No, I'm not going to do that." And so we fought with him for a long time. Now, I had some other business associates in this company. And these guys said, "Well, stop fighting here with the OSHA people over here, and let's just go ahead and bite the bullet, and let's just go ahead and put it in." And so reluctantly, I said, "Well, okay." And so we spent $8,000, and then we put in this spray booth. And the OSHA man came back, And he wrote it off, and he said, "Well, okay, that's good. You've got a good spray booth now, and we're satisfied. And everything's fine." And now this was a state of the art. This is the most modern state of the art spray booth that you can put in here. You know, the lights are in the walls. And we got this humongous fan. And, oh God, it just had all. It had whistles and bells, and just really a cat's meow kind of thing. Was my painter happy with it? Not really. Not really. He was more happy, he told me, with the old spray booth that he had designed and put together. He was not opposed to the OSHA spray booth. It had some good points to it, but there were some things that he didn't like about it. And one of the things was the god-awful noise, which was attendant with this big fan that we put in there. Of course, the bigger the fan, the more air it pulls through, and the more air it pulls through, well, then the louder the noises are. And that was one of the things he complained about. It wasn't number one necessarily, but it was something. Well, some time went by, and the EPA inspector came in. Now, EPA means the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, Congress enacted OSHA to protect the health and the safety of the workers. And their story was, as well, all of us employers, we're out here trying to kill our employees. We have careless disregard, and we don't care about them. We just care about ourselves and profits and the bottom line. That wasn't my experience. My experience was when my employees wanted something, I gave it to them because it was an incentive to produce more. And every employer wants his employees to produce more. And as a result of that, we make money. Now, if your employees want something and you say, not by the hair on my chinny chin chin, it's demoralizing, your employee doesn't like that, he slows down, he doesn't produce as much, and it's totally counterproductive. You could spend $100 on some small improvement that your employee wants, and he'll produce $1,000 off of this new investment, and he'll do that because it's in his self-interest and it's in your self-interest. Because, you see, it's in my self-interest as the employer to give my employee what he wants so that he'll work harder and produce more, not to thwart him so that he'll work less and produce less. Now, bureaucrats don't understand that because, see, they've never met a payroll, they've never had employees, and they don't know what business is all about. They're there to regulate business, but they're not businessmen. They're what we call business boys. Bureaucrats are not businessmen. Bureaucrats are business boys. They're wannabe businessmen. They'd like to be, but they can't make the grade. So that's why I call them business boys. Now, there's a lot of those out there. There's a lot of people that are in the business world that are business boys. But when it comes to bureaucrats, now these guys, they are without a doubt the champions. The champions of business boy is a government bureaucrat. So here comes the EPA man in, and when he got to the spray booth, he looked it over and he says, "Oh my God, this will never do. This thing has to be ripped out and a new spray booth put in here." So I pointed out to him with great pride that we had just rebuilt the spray booth, and we rebuilt it to OSHA standards. The OSHA people came in here and they didn't like it, and so they insisted that we fix it, and so we fixed it and we did it to their standards. And this EPA guy said, no. Those guys don't know how to build spray booths. We do. And you got to rip this thing out, and then you got to replace it with something that we approve. And so I start fighting with them, and I said, not by the hair on my chinny chin chin. So the OSHA people, they took that kind of hard. They didn't care too much for that. And I kind of suspect that it had to do with an encounter that I had with one of the OSHA inspectors. I'll tell you that little story when we come back. Meanwhile, I got to remind you that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, for more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk in the law. Our website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, in learning from our mistakes, sometimes we grow up to be old men, and then we wake up and we say, I would have been better off if I hadn't done that. But one day an OSHA guy came in, a Japanese fellow, and he wanted to do an inspection in the plant, see? And so I thought this was America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, and I said, do you have a search warrant? And he said, I don't need a search warrant. Now, I thought he needed a search warrant. That was my error. I was ignorant. I didn't know. But I thought here in America, if you wanted to come in and search somebody's house, search their business, their property or something, needed a search warrant. But you see, when you have a business license, you have a contract, you have an agreement with the state. And under Hale versus Hinkle, corporations, don't need a search warrant. So not understanding that, I told him to go get one, and he got a little uppity with me, and he raised his voice, and he raised his voice in my office. And so I just got up and threw the little jet bastard out in the street, and I told him, I thought we settled this at Pearl Harbor, or after Pearl Harbor. But I guess he thought that might have been a little racist, and maybe he thought that was kind of uncivilized of me, but let's see if we can learn something from this. Now, the government is pictured as being our friends, and they're there to help. And so I'm sitting here saying, well, how is this government going to help me by coming in here and searching my factory? Now, if the government agent came in, and let's suppose we let him in, and he finds some violations, and he writes up these violations and says, now, I'm from the government, and I'm here to help you. Let's correct these deficiencies over here so that nobody gets hurt, and he walks out the door. That would be a help. But the OSHA guys, when they come in and write you up, and every one of those write-ups is a $140 fine. So after that happened to me a couple of times, I said, these guys aren't in here to help me. And I really don't think they're in here to help our employees. I think that they're in here to help themselves. And they help themselves with these fines. Now, the government's running a business, and their business is to contract with me so that I waive my rights, and then they can find me in violation of their rules. And they're the ones that make up all the rules. I don't have any input. This OSHA book is 726 pages. That's right, 726 pages in the OSHA book. That's back about 1978, something like that. And so after they wrote me up here three times, I said, oh, hell, you're going to need a search warrant to come in here. And then I threw him out in the street. Well, some time went by. One day a young fellow came in there and he said he wanted a job. Now, I didn't hire people off the street, didn't need to, because I had a waiting list of people that wanted to work there. And so I just went to my list when an opening came up. But he came back and he was insistent. He came back, 4 or 5 times. And he told me about how much he wanted to learn the furniture business and how he just thought I was the greatest thing since sliced white bread. And he'd heard about me and blah, blah, blah. And so after about 4 or 5 times, an opening came up and I called this guy. I moved him way up ahead of all the other guys on the list. And I said, hey, Bob, come on in here. We got an opening and I'll put you to work. So we did. We put him to work. Now remember, this is after we threw the little OSHA guy out. Now, we've got some litigation going on here with OSHA. They don't take that land down, see, and so we've got hearings and cases and, litigation. And this guy's working away here. And one day he said to me, now, Mr. Gordon, he said, now, I got my mama, and she's sitting over here, and I'd like to take some pictures around the factory. Could I take some pictures here so I could send them to my mama? I said, well, certainly, Tom, go ahead. Just take all the pictures you want. And so, here's this guy. He's running around the factory. He's taking pictures of this and taking pictures of that. So this goes on for a while. I never thought much about it. Some more time goes by, and one day, and it wouldn't take very long either, about 2 or 3 weeks, and then one day the guy came to me and he said he's going to quit. And I said, quit? Why, I moved you up to the head of the list because you wanted to work here so bad. Now you've been here for 2 or 3 weeks, and now you're going to quit. And so, well, that's it. And so he left, didn't give me any notice either. He just up and quit. Well, some more time went by, and one day I got a complaint served on me from OSHA, and they said that I had all these violations going on. There's about 6, 8, 10 things that's complained about here, but I'm just going to tell you about one of them. Show you how this goes and how you learn from your mistakes here. See? And so One of the complaints was that we didn't have a saw guard on a DeWalt table saw, which is an obvious violation because you got to have this guard on. Well, but sup. See, there's a but sup. If you've got a dado head on this saw, you're not using it as a saw now, you're using it as a dado cutter, which is a special type of head that's used for a different kind of woodworking, then you don't need this guard on here. See? So when I saw that, I went down to the employees that have that saw, and I, on discovery, I got pictures of this saw with this guy operating the saw without a saw guard. And this picture has got a saw blade in here, and it's without a saw guard. And here's a picture, and it's taken by this guy who turned out to be an undercover OSHA inspector. See? Ah, the plot thickens. See, this is the government now sending in an undercover operative to catch me. This isn't the government in here trying to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the workers. Listen to this. When I asked the employee, what in the hell are you doing running this saw down here without the saw guard so that this guy can take a picture of you? Are you in cahoots with this guy? He says, no. And so he said, well, here's what happened, boss. And he said, I was sitting there eating lunch, and this guy came along, and he said that he needed to take some pictures to send to his mother. And I said, yeah, I'd help him. And it had a dado cutter in it. And so I took the dado cutter out, and I put a saw blade in. And then he said, here, just go ahead and start cutting the board here. Don't waste a lot of time putting the saw guard on there. Just start cutting the board. Let me take the picture, and then you can go back to eating your lunch. And so that's what I did. And then I took the saw blade out and put the dado cutter back in. I just put the saw blade on for his picture. Ah, you know what that's called, boys and girls? It's called entrapment. See, that's a government agent suggesting a crime and encouraging you to commit that crime so that he can prosecute you. It doesn't have anything to do with the health, safety, and welfare of the public, the employees. What they're trying to do is to build a case against me because they're mad at me because I demanded a search warrant and threw their inspector out. Now, government sometimes gets to be vindictive. Some government agents are that way. So that was one. And as it turned out, all of the charges were done the same way. He had a bunch of charges here that he had dummied up. And so I went in. OSHA has their own court. So I went into the OSHA court, and I produced witnesses, evidence, and testimony from my employees. We went in and testified as this is what he did. He came in here and entrapped us for the express purpose, and here's his motive. It's revenge. And when it was all said and done, the judge threw all the charges out and upbraided the agents. And from that point on, I didn't have much problem with OSHA from that point on. After we burned OSHA on that entrapment case, the OSHA people backed off. But now, you see, now that we put in the spray booth for them, spent the $8,000. Now here comes the EPA man. Remember, I mentioned this EPA guy, and he says, hey, this will never do. I said, you know, this is America, the land of the free and the home of the brave. You can't have one agency come in here and tell you got to meet these standards, and then when you meet these standards, another agency comes in and says, no, you got to rip that out and meet our standards. Well, is there a third, fourth, and fifth agency? I mean, is there ever an end to this? Now your common sense tells you that something's phony here. And so I resisted the EPA guys. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And I said, I build it to OSHA standards, and that's the bottom line, and you can go suck on an egg. So anyway, some time went by. Now, I want you to know that you get to pay for all of this. See this entrapment thing going on? You get to pay with your tax dollars for this kind of thing, which causes people like me to, at some point in time, say, you know, I've had enough of this. Enough's enough. And then they just quit. Now, I used to employ 30 people in that factory and produce $1 million a year. Today, I'm happy to report to you that I employ no one, produce nothing, and pay no taxes. Well, I don't pay any taxes, but I don't pay income tax. Now, that's counterproductive to you. It's counterproductive to society, but it isn't counterproductive to me because I don't need it. And those 30 employees, now here we are entering into another depression. Now, we need all the employment we can get. But you know, you got a George Gordon says, I'm not going to sit here and fight with a bunch of damn government bureaucrats over here raising hell with me. To hell with that. Government's not doing the employment scene any favors by sending OSHA inspectors out here to entrap us. All right, now the EPA guy, some time goes by. One day they came in with a complaint, and they said, hey, Gordon, you're over here polluting the air. And you're polluting the air. And they had 33 violations of polluting the air. And then they say, well, each one of those violations is a $1,000 fine and 6 months in jail. Well, if you have 33 violations, you know, they like to print this up in the paper. So you're faced with a $33,000 fine. And then 6 months in jail on each count would be 17 years in jail, wouldn't it? And so, you know, when they write this up in the newspaper, they say, and the owner, George Gordon, is facing 17 years in prison and a $33,000 fine for polluting the air. So I was a little bit bummed out, to say the least. And so I said, well, I built this to OSHA standards, and if it's polluting the air, well, then it's OSHA's fault, not mine. We put in all the equipment, did everything they told us I wanted to do. And so the case went to trial. So, you know, I had to hire a lawyer. At that time, I couldn't handle the case myself. And not too dumb. I'm just a businessman. I couldn't defend myself in any way, shape, form, or manner. But I found this old Mormon lawyer named Ben Rison. I went out there, and now the EPA guys came in one day, and they said, look, if you'll plead guilty to this, we'll take a $300 fine, and then that's strike one. And I said, I don't want to plead guilty to this under any circumstances, because we're not guilty of anything. We're not doing anything wrong here. We're doing just exactly what government agents told us to do, and now you seek to punish us. And so one of my business associates, he said, no, we went out and hired another lawyer named Bickle, and Bickle went in, got this plea bargain deal. We're going to go ahead and plead guilty. The corporation's going to plead guilty and pay him $300 and then put it behind us and we'll go to work. So a guy told me about this old Mormon lawyer, and I said, well, I'm going to talk to this guy. And so I told this old guy my trouble. He kind of laughed, and he said, yeah, that's the way the government works, you know. They're in business to make money off these fines, and they don't have a case against you, but, you know, they're going to intimidate you into pleading guilty. And then you're going to pay that $300 fine, see, and then that's strike one. And then they'll come back and do it again, and then it'll be strike two. And then they'll come back, and they'll really nail you. The third time they get you, you become a repeat offender, and then that's a felony. Then they'll really burn you. They'll burn you with that felony three times. I said, so really, this is a ruse to get to me. He said, yeah, that's right. And I said, well, does anybody ever fight back? And he says, no, nobody ever fights back, because, you see, if you want to hire me to defend you, I'm going to charge you $4,000. And I'll go in there and I'll beat them, but it'll cost you $4,000. But see, you can go in there and plead guilty and just cave in, and it'll only cost you $300. And so you will always take $300 against $4,000 until you get down here to the third time, when at that point in time you have no choice but to hire me. Then I won't charge you $4, I'll charge you $12, but then I can't win because you've already got these two convictions behind you. So it'll cost you $12,000 to lose. Now, you starting to follow this, boys and girls? So this is something for us to learn from, you know, these mistakes, you know. Now, if you can learn from my mistakes, then you can learn by revelation. If you think government's your friend, then you're a space case. Government's not your friend, hasn't been your friend, taint now, and isn't going to be in the future. George Washington, I think, hit the nail on the head. He said, government's like a fire. If you can keep it under control, that's good. It'll warm you, and it'll be your servant. But when it gets out of control, it burns your house down. So I went, I said to this guy, I said, now, are you going to guarantee that you're going to win for $4,000? He said, no. And I said to him, I said, now, if you came into my store and you wanted to buy a bedroom suite and you're going to spend $4,000, you'd want that guaranteed, wouldn't you? And he said, yeah. I said, now, I can go in there and pay $300 and walk out the door. But you want $4,000 and you ain't going to guarantee that you win. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'll pay you your $4,000. And then we struck a deal. And if you win, I'll pay you zero if you lose. $4,000 to win, zero to lose. He mulled it over a little bit, and he says, okay, you're on. $4,000 to win, zero to lose. I went back and announced that to my partner. My partner just went ballistic on me. He said, our deal is $300. We're pleading guilty, and on Wednesday I'm going in and plead guilty. And if you don't, I'll come in and testify against you. That was my old friend Peter Watt. We were never good friends after that. When your friends tell you that they're going to go testify for the government against you, and they're not much in the way of friends. So I got a little uppity, and I said, well, Pete, the government's got a pretty weak case in my view, and I think they're going to need all the help they can get, so why don't you go in there and testify for them? So he went in on Wednesday, pled guilty. He paid $300. I didn't. On Friday, 2 days later, we went in and tried the case. Now, the government came in, and they had spent a lot of time, effort, and energy gathering evidence against us, and they charged us under Title 19, Section 411 or something like that, and said we were polluting the air. Now, where did they get that statute? Well, they got that statute out of California because, see, in our state, it was reserved. It was reserved. And they went to California, pulled those statutes out, and then pretended that they were from Idaho, charged us under California regulations in Idaho, and then made their presentation. Well, it didn't take Ben long to move to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case, and the judge dismissed, and we walked out the door. And not only did I owe him the $4,000, but the guy, he said, if I win, you buy lunch. If I lose, I buy lunch. So I'll do the case free and buy lunch if I lose. So he went in, and he won the case. I was so dumb when we walked out of the courthouse for lunch. And I asked him who was going to testify first in our half of the case, you know, when we went in this afternoon. He says, we're not coming back. I said, why not? He says, well, because we won. I said, well, when did we win? I said, we won when the judge dismissed. See, I thought the judge was dismissing us for lunch. Shows you how dumb I was. And I was a businessman with 30 employees. Now, I hate to have to admit that, but it's time that we learn from our mistakes. See, I thought now government was our friend, and this is where I learned that government isn't our friend. Government is a competing business. Government is a competing business against the taxpayers. The taxpayers are the customers. They're there to sell those taxpayers the goods. And have you noticed how your government, how your Congress is selling you, the taxpayers, the goods? It's called bailout. They're bailing out. And so far, they've spent $12.8 trillion taxpayer dollars on these bank bailouts. They haven't spent 5 cents on anybody's mortgage. They're telling you that this is to save the people and keep them in their houses and to pay these mortgages. And to do that, they said, we got to bail the banks out. Bailing the banks out doesn't solve the guy's problem that has the mortgage and the banks. Just last night, I saw the banks have raised the interest rates on people from, you know, 6-7% to 13%, in some cases from 13 or 14%, they've raised it to 29%. So they're raising your interest rates at the same time you're giving them trillions of dollars to bail them out, and they're not doing a thing to save your house or your mortgage. Now, you're going to tell me now that the government's our friend and the government's going to save us from this Great Depression? And if you do, I'm going to tell you now, son, you got your head so far up your rectal region, you're probably never going to see daylight if you live to be 110. And that's why I say, you know, it's time to learn from the mistakes of others. Now, I've been through this. I've been there, and I've done that. I paid my dues. So by passing these little stories on to you, that was my experience. And if you deal with OSHA, the EPA, or your government, you're probably going to get about the same result that I got. A kick in the ass. All right, we're out of time, so let me give you a final reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review and sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.